I'm Mark Simpson, and this is a special edition of Intersection. The Tuskegee Airmen were the nation's first black military aviators. They served during World War II, defending the country at a time when the military and federal government were segregated and Jim Crow laws existed in many states. Nearly 1,000 pilots and 15,000 ground personnel served as Tuskegee Airmen. They were part of the U.S. Army Air Corps. This week, Intersection travels to the Aviation Museum Fantasy of Flight in Polk City for an interview with two Tuskegee Airmen from Florida. Together, they have nearly 70 years of military experience. Also, we'll hear from Rosa Parks' niece, who recently moved to Central Florida. But first, the Tuskegee Airmen, taped at Fantasy of Flight Aviation Museum in Polk City, ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by George Hardy, who flew combat missions in Germany, Korea, and Vietnam. George, great to have you with us.
Well, glad to be here.
I'm also joined by Leo Gray, who spent 41 years on active duty and in the reserves. Great to have you, too, Leo.
Thank you for having us.
So talk to me a little bit about how you both ended up being Tuskegee Airmen. George, what made you want to be a pilot, and how did you get put into this famous unit?
Well, during World War II, I wanted to get into service, but I was 17 in 1943 when I took the exam for the aviation cadet to go to Tuskegee. I passed it, and they sent me home until I turned 18. And I finally got orders in June to report 13th of July, and I went to Keesler Field for basic training, then to Tuskegee in December of 43. And actually, I started as an aviation cadet in December 43 and graduated in June 44.
And what about for you, Leo?
September 44.
Okay. And what about for you, Leo? Why did you want to become a pilot, and how did you end up at Tuskegee?
Well, I didn't want to get drafted. The options weren't very good if you got drafted, because back in those days, blacks were going into the Navy as stewards or some other menial task, or into the Army, and generally in quartermaster, and doing dirty type work. That didn't appeal to me. I said if I became an aviation cadet, I could become a pilot. In those days, it looked like the pilots were the glamour boys of the military, and that didn't sound too bad. So I opted to take the test in November 43. I graduated from high school in that summer in 42, and I got called to active duty in May 43, and I graduated in August of 44 and ended up with the 100th Fighter Squadron in Italy.
So tell me about the perception of the Tuskegee training at that time. Today we look back at the Tuskegee Airmen as a celebrated group of pilots and ground personnel that were an established fighting unit. What was the perception of going to Tuskegee at that time in World War II, George?
Well, it was just an opportunity to do something for your country, but also an opportunity to get ahead. Flying seemed like a glamorous job, and it took quite a bit of knowledge and whatnot to even get into the Aviation Cadet Corps. And so I wanted that. And just to fly, that was the key.
Was it known then as being a primarily African-American route for aviators to get into the service?
Well, I guess the first class started in 1941, summer 1941. They graduated in 42. And all during their training and whatnot, we got a lot of info on the black newspapers, the Philadelphia Tribune, and the Pittsburgh Courier. And reading that, you sort of felt you would like to do that. And so it was something to look forward to.
Leo, what was the perception in the African-American community at the time of the Tuskegee Airmen?
This was the prestigious, probably top-of-the-line group for blacks in the military. And everywhere we went, the pilots were highly regarded in the black community, just like the pilots in the white community were highly regarded. Vis-a-vis the rest of the folks, we fared quite well.
And was it a completely segregated unit?
Completely. Interestingly enough, when you ask that question, we have an organization, the Tuskegee Airmen Incorporated. And when I went to Tuskegee, apart from primary flight instructors who were all black, all the rest of the instructor personnel I encountered were white. However, I only know of two whites that have stepped to the plate and acknowledged being part of the Tuskegee Airmen experience since then. And we've been we've been floating around since 1973 when our charter was adopted. And we've got books to prove that we had a lot of white officers down there, so they can't deny that they were there because it's a vivid picture. But they don't acknowledge it. I don't know why.
Do you think, did you deal with racial discrimination within that unit at all, or was it only if you had to interact with the outside community?
As long as we stayed on the base. Now, you see, George and I came in the middle of the program, and the experiences that people had in the beginning of the program were different than those which we experienced. When I came along, I encountered no overt discrimination that I was aware of with respect to our interactions with the instructor personnel. Now, until I graduated, the bases throughout the military establishment adhered to the discriminatory Jim Crow laws of the South. Right after I graduated, or about the time, the War Department came up with a directive to integrate facilities on military bases. Colonel Parrish, who was the base commander at Tuskegee, adhered to that ruling, saying that Tuskegee was the United States Army Air Force base. It was not subject to the laws of Alabama. And when I graduated, I came home from leave, and I saw these white officers sitting on the steps of the post exchange eating brown bag lunches, and I said, "Why don't you go inside?" He said, "Well, it's against the law in Alabama for whites and blacks to eat under the same roof." That was their problem, because they could have gone inside because Colonel Parrish said you could. But that was the only base that had happened. When we completed our transition, we went to Waldorf, South Carolina, and things were a lot different there. We took all the signs off the buses and sat in the theater. We had a great time.
Now, obviously, even today, being a pilot is something special. And in World War II, you're only 40 years past the Wright brothers making that first historic flight. And being an aviator, certainly you were pushing boundaries. And you were also pushing boundaries being black aviators. Did you know you were doing something special at that time?
Well, it's hard to say. It wasn't that you were doing something special. You wanted to go into pilot training. You succeeded, and you ended up going overseas and flying with the group overseas. But it wasn't a matter of that we looked at it as something special or historic. It's just that we felt we could do it, and we did. Mm-hmm. And that was it. It was just a personal accomplishment. So,
one thing I think you have to recognize is that the people who were selected for the program were sort of the cream of the crop, and especially those from the northern states. I know I had never had felt that I was a second class to anybody when I went in, because in high school I enjoyed a situation where I was on the honor roll and I was top, so I was the best athlete the fastest runner on my track team. I had the first seat. I played the trumpet, first seat in the trumpet of my band, my school band, and I had Boston Public School Symphony Band, and I ended up in the first seat there. So why should I feel inferior to anybody? And no basis. And I think the rest of the guys, like George and others, had similar experiences. So you didn't have people coming into the program that had inferiority complexes.
Mm-hmm. So, George, your father was black, and your mother almost all white.
Well, actually, my mother was almost all white, and my father still had some white in his background. But basically, the family I grew up with was my father's, and they were basically black. And so they're the people that I lived with, grew up with, and who loved me, and I loved them.
So how did you end up being in the Tuskegee Airmen Division, which was identified as kind of a black unit?
Well, because of the fact that during World War II, or during the period, the definition of who's white and black was, they call them colored, because any measure of black, you're colored, say. and so you're part of that group. And they're the group I grew up with, say, and they're the people I felt comfortable with. And so when I applied, I made sure I was applying to go to Tuskegee.
You're listening to The Intersection on 90.7 WMFB-FM. I'm talking with Tuskegee Airman George Hardy and Leo Gray. I'm Mark Simpson. Have you gone to see the movie Red Tails or been looking into the Tuskegee Airmen lately? Tell us about your experience on Facebook or Twitter or email over at intersection@wmfe.org. So fast forward with me to when you actually got into planes and you moved into theater. What was that like flying in the latter stages of World War II, Leo?
Great airplane.
You're flying the Mustang.
Mustang. We did our combat training in P-47 Thunderbolts at Waldoboro, but when we got overseas, they gave us P-51s.
And was it a better plane?
The Thunderbolt, the P-47, was like driving a Cadillac, and the P-51 was like driving a sport car.
So did you prefer the Mustang then?
Well, I like both of them, depending upon what you were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to do ground support work, give me a P-47 any day. But for high altitude, long range activity, you needed the P-51.
And what was it like flying over the skies then? Was there still a lot of threat from enemy fire from the ground and from the air?
Yeah, it depends upon where you were at times. And a lot of folk think that because the war was near an end, the Germans were pretty much out of it, but we were still getting pilots shot down. And if you got shot down, I don't care when it was, if you did, you did.
Was that your experience as well, Drew?
Yes, it was. But I will say this, that at 19 years old, second lieutenant flying a P-51, that's like being on top of the world. Because a P-51 was such a responsive airplane. It's just a beautiful airplane for the mission. And although when I got over there, I just happenstance. I didn't run into any German airplanes in the air on the missions I flew. The only time I fired my guns was on strafing missions. That is, after we escorted the bombers, you'd go down, look for targets of opportunity, trucks, trains, or barges, whatnot.
And that was over Germany?
That was over Germany, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what did you think you were accomplishing in the European theater at that time as World War II was wrapping up? Did you feel like you could see the end was near, or were you just continuing on as long needed?
Well, you knew the end was near, because on our briefings, we'd be briefed as to the status of the advance of the Allied troops, the Russian troops on the Eastern Front, and the Allied troops on the Western Front. And you could see that Germany was being squeezed. And the fact that you didn't run into as many airplanes attacking bombers meant that the Luftwaffe was having problems, too. So we could have sensed that it wouldn't be too long before the war ended.
We could see the troops moving across Europe, the dusters. The Red Ball Express, for example, was moving east, and the lines were moving up in Italy. We had some targets of opportunity missions, and the first wave of planes went out. They were gone an hour. We got word that the front lines had moved up 60 miles, and they were beyond radio range. And fortunately, none of our guys opened fire. They went down on a convoy, but someone recognized it as a friendly force, and we didn't open fire, but that was not the case with some of the other groups. And later on, after the war, I was up in Milan, came back, and someone said, "Did you have any trouble up there?" And I said, "No, we had a great time." "Well, why?" And, "Well, fellows from the 10th Mountain Division were beating up pilots. They saw them in Milan because they strafed them, and some of our friendly fire problems were rather severe."
What were some of the most important missions that you were involved in?
I guess all of them were. But one that I recall that was interesting to me, that we escorted a P-38 and we encountered a couple of German ME-262 jets. Fortunately, the encounter was not finalized. They came in to attack us, and they broke off when they saw us drop wing tanks. This was a week after the Berlin mission, and I think they remembered Berlin. And we had destroyed three jets over Berlin. We probably destroyed two others, and we probably destroyed a rocket plane, and we damaged three. We lost one. So they knew who the Red Tails were.
Was it hard to engage those fighters that the Germans were putting out that were so advanced?
Not if they came close within range, but we could. They were about 100 miles an hour faster than us.
So how did you counter it?
We would just catch them as they went by, and if you were lucky. But if they want to try to get you, they have to come at you. If they went by us and we were in the right spot at the right time, we could catch them. But it was the luck of the draw.
So coming away from World War II, what did you feel were the biggest accomplishments for the Tuskegee Airmen? Was it in the combat skies? Was it back home on the home front advancing racial equality? Where do you think the legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen lies?
In both. We had a presidential unit citation for our mission to Berlin. We managed to destroy a damaged 409 enemy aircraft. 112 were in aerial combat, and we lost 12. Now, for people who were not supposed to be able to fly, that's a 10-to-1 kill ratio. Hey, that wasn't bad. Back in the States, we had a medium bombardment group that never had the opportunity to go overseas, and they encountered a record racial incident at Freeman Field where they arrested 101 officers and court-martialed three, and their crime was attempting to go into a white officers' club against the orders of the base commander and the commander of the 1st Air Force, who were in violation of War Department orders themselves. And we had the War Department orders after I had graduated from high school, from pilot training, and this was in April 1945, and they court-martialed three fellows and convicted one. It was later overturned, but those incidents are matters of record, and I think the performance of the Tuskegee Airmen experiment was such that it contributed largely to President Truman's decision to sign Executive Order 9981 to eliminate discrimination in the military.
Georgia, what do you think about that legacy question? Where does it lie?
Well, the thing is that the performance of the Tuskegee Airmen in Europe, Remitelli was a all-black base, and they were able to do as well as any of the other groups as far as number of airplanes put in the air every day and the missions they flew. And so it meant that the ground crew was also doing their jobs. And so the Air Force became a separate service in September 1947 and was put on a par with the Army and the Navy. And shortly after, within months of being a separate service, they initiated a study. Head of Personnel of the Air Force initiated a study on racial integration within the Air Force. And in April 48, the Chief of Staff announced that they were going to move ahead with this thing of equal opportunities, that is racial integration within the Air Force. They didn't give a date for it, but said they were going to move ahead with that. And several months later, President Truman in July issued his executive order. And the Air Force was ready to go with integration. And in July of 49 was the official date, 1st of July, where the outfits at Lockburn were inactivated, the 332nd, and everyone there received orders transferring to Air Force bases all over the world. And that was the start of integration. And a lot of it had to do with the Air Force people recognizing that those guys at Remitelli did as good a job as anyone else, not only the pilots, but the ground crew also. So they felt these individuals could then make it anywhere. And so that's when integration started, as far as the military service. Started with the Air Force in 1 July 1949. And that's another story, going ahead with integration. So
it was a jump start to that. We might add that the Air Force had a Top Gun competition at Nellis Field outside of Las Vegas, the first Top Gun competition for the Air Force. And the team from the 332nd Fighter Group out of Lockburn won first place. The day after they got back, they decided to follow up with the integration. So that Top Gun competition might have been an impetus to help jumpstart the change.
You both had connections to the military after World War II. Leo, you were in the reserves for a
yes.
number of years, and George, you served all the way through Vietnam. Did that Tuskegee Airmen distinction stay with you through your military career, and how was it accepted or treated in later years?
Well, it maybe was a factor, But after integration, we had problems for a number of years. If you worked for someone who, many officers in the Air Force did not agree with the Air Force's decision. And you had many people who just didn't like the fact that blacks were on a par with everyone else. And when you serve with people like that, you had problems. I worked for two people in 1950 and later in 1953 who didn't want me in their outfit. It created problems, but after that, integration seemed to work very well, basically, because the services became, I guess, the most integrated portion of our society for a while.
And for you, Leo?
Oh, I had no problem with that. Matter of fact, in reserve, I was commander of a research and development flight at Berkeley when I retired, and the problems of the discrimination and so forth were not relevant in my situation.
And finally, the movie Red Tails is out right now, talking about the Tuskegee Airmen. What do you guys think about that film?
Great movie. If you don't see it, you haven't lived.
Good, real action and an action movie.
Well, I've been speaking with Tuskegee Airman George Hardy and Leo Gray. George Hardy flew combat missions in Germany, Korea, and Vietnam. Leo Gray spent 41 years on active duty and in the reserves. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Next on Intersection, Rhea McCulley is Rosa Parks' niece, who recently moved to Central Florida. Ahead, she talks about her famous aunt. ...1955 was a momentous year for the U.S. civil rights movement. On December 1st, Rosa Parks, considered the mother of the modern-day civil rights movement, was arrested after refusing to give up her seat to a white male passenger on a bus in Montgomery. Those events kicked off a boycott of city bus lines that lasted 381 days, which Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. helped to organize. Here to discuss the legacy of Rosa Parks is her niece, Rhea McCulley. Rhea, very nice to speak with you.
Very nice to be here. I take every opportunity I can to talk about Auntie Rosa and her legacy.
Well, let me ask you about Rosa Parks, your Aunt Rosa Parks. What was that relationship like with her? How close were you guys?
Oh, we were very close. And you can tell by the pictures that she took. I mean, she was at all our weddings. She was at, she wasn't at my divorce, but she was at our weddings, at graduations. Not only that, she was a great aunt because she was at my children's graduation. So, you know, she loved us all dearly.
What kind of person was she?
Oh, goodness. She's very quiet, very mild-mannered. Matter of fact, as a kid, Auntie Rosa had an expressive face because I'm an artist. You could read whatever she was feeling right on her face, you know, by her eyes, by her eyebrows, you know, just the way she looked. She would look at us, and we would immediately come to attention.
All it took was a look.
Absolutely.
Well, what do you remember most about her?
I remember her gentleness. I remember Auntie Rosa being very, very self-controlled. She had a stance and a posture about her. If she was upset with you, you simply knew it. I mean, like I said, she was... she had a very expressive posture and face.
Did she have a key phrase that she used to say or an expression she always used? Or?
Well, no, it wasn't a phrase, but it was more like an expression. Being so closely related to Auntie Rosa, there were many events that we had to go to. And at this particular point, we were renaming 12th Street, which is a major thoroughfare in the city of Detroit, Rosa Parks Boulevard. So there was ceremony and there was, the politicians were out. And I happened to be a young mother and my first family were little. And as I approached Auntie Rosa, because at these events, you have a bodyguard, you've got people, you know, just, you know, surrounding her. One of the ladies that organized the event was pushing me back with my three little ones. Auntie Rosa just simply looked up at the lady and she said, "Do you mind? I'm trying to get my baby." you know, which happened to be my oldest son at the time. I thought that was so cool. I mean, for her to say, and Lady was so apologetic, and, you know, she felt bad because here I was, a young mother, and I have my three little ones, and she looked, she's, oh, my goodness, I'm so sorry, Mrs. Parks. I thought that was cool.
It sounds like a very wonderful person. When did you know, though, as a child, when did you know and make that connection that she was Rosa Parks of the civil rights movement, or did you always know?
I did not always know, and I can tell you that when you grow up in a family, this is just considered normal. And please don't anybody laugh. I did not realize the impact that Auntie Rosa had on people all over the world until a short 7 years ago. And maybe everybody would say, well, that's impossible for somebody like that to do what she did for the rest of us. But it's not when you think about it, because Auntie Rosa in our family has always been my aunt, you know, my aunt. I didn't realize until we actually started getting letters pouring in from Japan, from Europe. When I saw the celebration over in England, for instance, I was just absolutely blown away. And it's still beginning to register on me just the type of impact that she's had, positive impact on people.
Why do you think that was? Was it within the family, just very humble in terms of portraying her impact on society?
Well, Auntie Rosa was not all that humble in the family, first of all. But secondly, if you think about the children of Dr. King, you think about the children of Malcolm X, these children actually grew up with these people that made such an impact on history. And it was the same way with the Macaulays. We grew up with Auntie Rosa. There were Sunday dinners. And, you know, like I said, you know, weddings. There was times when she would fuss at me, you know, because I happen to be the troublemaker of the family.
You?
Yes. I'm the troublemaker. So,
well, how did Auntie Rosa handle the troublemaker?
Well, because Auntie Rosa, she has such a variety of nieces to pick from. I mean, I'm one of eight. So, see, you have a plethora of nieces. So you don't really need to take the little big mouth troublemaker with you. You could choose a little quiet one. So typically that's what it was. You know, I think she tried for several years to get me to settle down and be quiet, you know, basically. And when she found out that that was not in my character or my makeup, then, you know, she would choose one of the quieter nieces.
Rhea Macaulay is niece to the late civil rights icon Rosa Parks. Rhea, thanks you so much for coming in and sharing your stories.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it. The questions were very, very insightful. Appreciate those questions.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening. ¶¶